Welcome to our newest adventure for first responder wellness. No one fights alone. In-depth conversations about mental health and culture in the first responder space. We're joined by your co-hosts, Austin Pedersen and Brad Shepard.
Hey, welcome back to the No One Fights Alone podcast. I am flying solo today. Austin has a couple things going on and he's not here, but I am super excited to have a really good new friend that I met, I don't know, months ago. We talked back and forth and got to visit and finally got to meet in person recently. She and her husband, Liz Pohl, Elizabeth Pohl, goes by Liz Pohl. Welcome to the No One Fights Alone podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, this is awesome. So Liz is a founder and CEO of an organization called Resilient Heroes, and we're going to talk a little bit more about that here in just a little bit. She is also a Chicago Police Department officer of 20 plus years and holds a master's degree in forensic psychology. Liz, I am so excited about our conversation today. Let's just start off by saying how excited I am about hearing this conversation, because I'm fascinated by what you do. And to give the listeners a little preview, we're going to talk about suicide and we're going to talk about suicide autopsies, which is, to me, I don't think really has much merit in this space. Is that fair? People don't talk about this.
It's been a long time coming. We really need to get this information out because it's so relevant to this problem that we have with suicide, and the information, there's a bit of a gap with the knowledge, and it really just explains a lot more in depth of suicide and all the information that we're missing.
Well, I absolutely love this. I think we're going to have a good time, but for the listeners, how about we just tell a little bit about who Liz is. Tell us a little bit about, give us a little insight there.
All right. So I am a Chicago police officer. I've been on for 20 years and I have my master's in forensic psychology. And then I went on to become a certified investigator in suicide psychological autopsies. And ultimately what I do is I take a case of suicide of a first responder and we dissect and go back psychologically to try to find where this manifested from and how the individual spiraled out to ultimately get to the point where they take their life. And very sad and unfortunate information, but at the same time, we have so much information that we gather and we see and we're able to understand how this occurred in order to be able to move forward in a proactive manner and try to maybe put certain things in place and look out for certain signs, symptoms, risk factors, so that we can ultimately identify what it is that we're seeing when an individual has suicidal ideation and could potentially go down that route. And we can be more proactive in trying to, you know, get involved and try to offer resources and handle the situation.
Yeah, I find it fascinating. I think the whole topic of suicide and specifically your arena is fascinating. I think should be talked about at length. But to kind of how do you end up? I mean, this is a pretty specific traffic lane that you're in. What's some of the backstory for Liz Pohl and how you got there? Where did you start developing this passion maybe originally and now find yourself on this?
It's a great question. So I got on the job when I was 23 years old. So I'm a kid. I don't even, looking back, it's kind of like, what was I thinking? Right. But very early on in my career, I started to pay attention to the chatter. This is how it all began. When we had a suicide on the job, I paid attention to a lot of the chatter that was going on in roll call, in the station, amongst the department, essentially. And I started to realize that there was a lot of, you know, how coppers can be. We tend to have questions or comments or whatever. I was paying attention to the fact that it seemed like everyone was trying to make sense of the suicide. And there was a lot of information that just was lacking. And everyone seemed to kind of always keep talking about why it happened. And they were all looking for one specific answer. And so a lot of people, what I would hear, especially was like, if somebody was going through like a difficult time in their marriage or divorce or something, they would say, oh, it's because, you know, he's going through a divorce or, you know, whatever. And for me, it kind of felt like, well, I don't know if that's necessarily a fact that it would be one specific reason, because then wouldn't we have just more suicides if it was just because of a divorce? So that's kind of where it became intriguing for me. And, you know, I was back in grad school. And like I said, I had was getting the master's in forensic psychology. I did a whole bunch of clinical work. And so for me, trauma and the suicide became what I really wanted to get involved in. And I really wanted to just understand, like, what is it exactly? What all goes on in an individual's life that they get to this point versus all the other people that don't? And so that's kind of where it began. And I moved on to get trained as a certified investigator. And as I've done the suicide psychological autopsies, I have found so much information, especially information that was staring all of us in the face. And we just couldn't identify. We didn't really know it was leading towards suicide. But then again, like anything else in life, if we're not trained, if we're not educated on something, how would we know? So it's not meant to place blame on anyone. And it's obviously not going to change the outcome. But it definitely can give us a lot of information so that we can now develop something where we can offer the info and the tools for first responders to be able to get through a lot of the crisis that we experience.
You know, I find it interesting. You're a couple things in what you're saying there of that I find fascinating. One is the why, which I think we'll probably get into that. But you just mentioned something about kind of defending the it's not meant to place blame. Have you found people getting pretty defensive with some of your work about you know, receiving information or feeling like they should have done more or wish they could have done more? I mean, has that been a challenge for you?
Not necessarily. I haven't really had an issue with people feeling any kind of blame or whatnot after the fact. I do feel that I think maybe some agencies are hesitant to do these because they don't want to have any blame placed on them if the job in any way, shape, or form had an effect, which typically there tends to be. And the families, if anything, friends, family, and a lot of individuals, coworkers, if anything, they don't feel blame. They actually end up having a sense of relief in a way and closure by understanding how this manifested and understanding what the individual was going through psychologically, emotionally, mentally, physically, etc. So it just kind of maybe gives a sense of closure to some of the individuals and more understanding.
Yeah, that makes sense that there would be really filling in some blanks. Of some unknowns. I know, you know, I've personally experienced a friend committing suicide, and there was just so much gaps, you know, left to, you know, and what I know about the mental health space is gaps are typically filled with worst case scenario type information, which sometimes results in I should have, or I wish I would have, or maybe I should have done this, maybe I should have done that.
It kind of gives some people relief to understand for those who do maybe question, like, did I do enough? Should I have done this? Whatnot. Once I break it down to them, you know, because I ultimately create a full report and it's pretty extensive, 13 plus pages of every wow. aspect of the individual's life that I really look into. And people start to see all the risk factors that were present in the individual's life. And then not just the risk factors, but protective factors that we need in our lives, right? That keep us going, that keep us from losing that hope, right? How those end up becoming diminished or altogether absent. And so then people start to understand like how the individual is ultimately really struggling and suffering in a sense. And it really isn't so much about what people did or didn't do. It's about the individual and what they were experiencing.
Well, take us on a little journey on an autopsy. But what does an autopsy look like? Let's just dive into that. If you were going to head into one, walk us through it.
So I would contact the family. Usually it's family, closest friends, coworkers of the individual that has died by suicide. And I explain to them what we're trying to achieve here with the information. And it's all done through interview of the closest people to the deceased individual's life. And we go back. With my background in psychology, there are certain points that I specifically will, you know, go to as far as questions to be asked. Sometimes information will come up or be said that, again, psychologically, I am able to pick up on, and I know what information is, you know, really important to kind of dive further into, and then more info comes out. And we just go over everything from like their physical history, mental health history, legal issues, family issues, family medical history with mental health, just so many different areas and aspects of the individual's life that I really just go into. We start for the most part with, you know, what the individual that I'm interviewing, how they just walk me through from the beginning of the suicide on, and then it just kind of like goes from there. And I have found so much information from an individual having mental health issues. And again, you don't necessarily have to have a mental health diagnosis to die by suicide. Some people don't have a mental health history or diagnosis, but you can or cannot. We have substance use and abuse issues that I find, a lot of interpersonal relationship issues. That's a big one. Stress, trauma is significant usually. And trauma can be anywhere from the trauma that we're dealing with on the job, which is so common for us. But in a lot of cases, there's a lot of trauma from prior to the job, childhood. We think, oh, we're in our 30s, 40s, 50s, like whatever, who cares about the trauma or that's so behind us that we endured when we were kids. But believe it or not, a lot of that trauma is still there, and it affects you as you get older and you become an adult. And in this work that we do, a lot of traumas from childhood are even triggered when we're on the job, and subconsciously we may not even be aware of that. So we see a lot of that, legal issues, interdepartmental issues that we're experiencing at times, you know, the support or not of the of your agency, if you've gotten involved in anything. So it's really all across the board.
What was some of the most I don't want to use the word shocking, maybe aha moments that you've found on some of these autopsies that you didn't expect maybe to see, because they're I mean, they're filling in blanks, right? They're right. So what, share with us some of the, maybe the, some of the inside of some aha moments for an autopsy.
I'm so glad that you bring that up, because this is one of the things I like to talk about, that people are just not even aware of. Psychotropic medications are the medications that were prescribed by psychiatrists. Typically, I mean, ideally, you should be under the care of a psychiatrist. And those are the medications that we use for antidepressants, antipsychotics, and mood stabilizers, right? So your bipolar disorders, your depression, anxiety, that's typically in our arena, like what we pretty much see. And these medications are unlike other drugs that just cannot be mismanaged. And I have found that a lot of individuals are under antidepressants that maybe their primary physicians have prescribed. And again, nothing wrong with that. A primary physician can legally prescribe you Xanax if you needed for sleep, for instance. However, these drugs, especially depending on the individual, because everyone's different, you should be monitored, and you should be, especially when you first start them, you should be monitored and having somebody manage how you're doing on them. And they shouldn't be used for long periods of time. The problem is a lot of individuals are just kind of taking them, you know, as needed, if you will. And then a lot of them are kind of mixing them with alcohol, which is the ultimate, like, just recipe for disaster. You know, and I've said this before, many a times we've taken medications like an antibiotic, and we've, all of us, right, at some point in our lives have had an antibiotic, maybe had a glass of wine or had a couple of drinks, maybe too many drinks, whatever, and ultimately nothing has tragically occurred, right? However, these type of medications, it is, they're so delicate that if you were to take, given the individual, a Xanax and maybe a glass of whiskey, that could be something that would set someone off into a psychotic episode or even suicide ideation. You know, so I've been finding that there are a lot of individuals that are on psychotropic medications and they're not being managed by the right doctor for the long period of time, and they're mixing, or even if alcohol or any of that isn't an issue, some of these medications, when I say they need to be managed, I mean, what I mean by that is when you're on them, some of them you can't just take for a couple days and then you stop taking them cold turkey. That actually presents a major problem, and it puts individuals into, you know, a bit of a psychotic break or some kind of mental episode, right? I mean, as police officers, think about it this way. When we go to these calls and we get the call of the individual who the family is saying, hey, you know, John is off of his medication. He has bipolar disorder and he hasn't taken his meds in 2 weeks. And now John is wrecking the house. This is the best way to give the example and describe, like, it's kind of like that. You can't just, these psychotropic medications are not medications that you just kind of, you know, pop a couple, you know, for 5 days, then I stop. And, you know, it's much trickier. And so that was very surprising. And I've been seeing more and more of it more often. And it's just devastating, because this is something that, you know, if we had a better handle on, and I feel that if we had first responders and general population more educated on, then, you know, we would avoid a lot of disaster.
What would be something to be cautious about? Because, you know, most of the people accept medical advice, wisdom, and prescriptions at face value with great deal of trust. And, you know, I'm certainly not trying to blame that medical physician, but is there something that if I were taking some of these medications, is there something that I could, that you could tell me to be cautious about in how I live out my life and stay, you know, have precaution to not these episodes up to and including suicide?
I mean, ultimately, from all of these autopsies, I've gathered so much information, which has also led me down the path of creating what I found to be a curriculum that will help a lot of first responders. It's basically trauma and suicide psychoeducation, right? I think that if we start educating and filling that gap of knowledge for first responders to understand, you know, what trauma is, all the mental health aspects, you know, everything about suicide that we don't know enough about, right? All those questions that we have. And if we start having first responders learn to self-advocate for themselves, right? Understand if you are in crisis or if you are having a hard time, what are the options available out there? Where do I begin? Who do I turn to? You know, when you're going to these doctors, what are the questions that you're supposed to be asking, you know, so that you are able to navigate, right? When we, I feel that with first responders, when we offer them the tools, like anything else, we go through firearms training, we go through defensive tactics skills. When we give the proper tools to our first responders to go out and do their job, we do well. It's when we don't know what to do or how to do it that we struggle, right? And typically, we're always in control and we know what to do, right? We're being called to deal with individuals we don't even know, going to homes we've never been to and make decisions for people. We don't do well when we don't know what to do, especially for ourselves, right? And sometimes we lack taking care of ourselves as well as we do others. So I feel that if we offer the proper tools, which is this psychoeducation, people will have more knowledge and have better options on what to do. So if I start to identify, oh yeah, okay, this is what they're talking about. This, I know something's kind of off with me, or I need to do something about this issue. We'll give them an option of learning where to begin, right? Who do you turn to? What resources are out there, right? It's not just, psychotherapy isn't the end all, right? It's one of the options out there for individuals, but
one tool,
right? And so having various resources, having knowledge on, hey, what is trauma and how does trauma affect me? I mean, we're human beings at the end of the day. If we were machines, it'd be different, right? But we're not machines. If we're not getting sleep, what does that ultimately do to us? Really think about it. We go without sleep. How different, like to a certain degree, how different is that from an individual who's intoxicated, impaired, and can't make the best decisions? So right. A lot of this information, this is the psychoeducation that, you know, I feel is important for us to go over and start the conversation of suicide. It's a tough topic. We don't really want to talk about this, but what we've been doing isn't working.
Well, that is clear. And I love the fact that we're able to have these conversations. So I want to circle back to kind of that question I posed a few minutes ago, which is some aha moments, which what you gave us was fascinating, which was the medications conversation. But maybe let's take another lane of traffic down this road of what else have you discovered that maybe would be enlightening to listeners in the suicide piece?
So it hasn't really been a bit of a shocker to me. It's just kind of been more, I think we know that alcohol is a major problem in this work that we do. And so it's not about telling people don't drink, right? We're all adults. We can do what we want when we want. We can make those decisions. However, what I've started, there haven't really been any autopsies that I've performed that I have not seen alcohol be an issue. Alcohol is there and it's a problem. So when I've developed this training and conversation that I want to have in the psychoeducation platform, the question I pose is, why are you drinking, right? When we're talking about trauma, especially, and we're talking about this work that we do, I think we need to start looking at the alcohol and the substance use from a lens of, why are you drinking, right? If I choose to want to go out and engage in some social drinking tonight with dinner with my friends or go to a festival or whatever it may be, I can do that. And that's fine. However, if I'm having intrusive thoughts of that child that has been a rape victim to a call that I've responded to, and I can't get those images out of my head when I'm at home or when I'm engaging with my children and these thoughts start popping in or it's affecting my sleep, and I want to turn to the alcohol to numb that, to shut those thoughts off, to be able to knock myself out to go to sleep, now we have a different problem.
No, I really think that motivation behind asking those questions about what is your motivation behind what you're doing. And I think alcohol is on the table, but there's a lot of things that should be asked. The why that you brought up early on, what is motivating you to do something that places yourself at risk? And I remember in my drinking, it was not as easy to see early on, but later in my drinking stages, I remember thinking, this is, I didn't know the why. I wasn't really even sure. I didn't know to ask those questions of myself, or maybe I didn't want to, but I knew my motivation was not just to go out and have a good time with some friends. And I think if the encouragement of, hey, ask yourself why you're doing what you're doing and what is the motivation behind it, I think that's a powerful question in this realm.
Yeah. It's when we're using it as a coping mechanism to try to escape the things mm-hmm. that we've experienced, the traumas that we've gone through on this job, the difficulties of our personal life and so on. You really need to examine, you know, what's going on here. And that's when it becomes a problem, because now the more that you're engaging in that, you're creating a dependence issue, which we're not even aware of maybe, right? Until you're already in it. And now it's like, oh gosh, now not only have I fueled the issues and the trauma that I'm already experiencing by like throwing this alcohol into it, I'm also creating a dependence issue. And so now you've got two issues that you're dealing with.
You know, I was told a story just, I was trying to remember what day it was recently. It's been within the last 7 days of a man who was engaging in conversation with this family, walked in the other room and shot himself in the head. And I mean, he was having a few drinks. But I had to wonder when I heard that story, I wonder if the alcohol didn't lend to the diminishment of inhibitions and really push him towards being okay with making that decision. Would you have made that decision in clear mind? You know, and I think you're validating, you know, some of that conversation of probably wouldn't have made that decision. We will never know. You know, that's that gap, right? We won't know the answer to that. But if he was not drinking, would he have made the same decision?
I will say that with suicide, I have found this is not something that someone just wakes up, everything in life is great. You just wake up and you decide, you know, I'm going to kill myself. It just doesn't happen that way. This is something that has been a long time coming, right? Some people contemplate for long periods of time, right? They go back and forth with it, right? And once they've made that final decision, that decision, it's not just random. Like, I just got up today and this is a thought. This is something that, you know, individuals have been struggling with something for a while, with many things actually that they've been struggling with. And it just gets to a point, they're spiraling, and it's just getting, their lack of judgment grows, you know, it's impaired. Their thinking is much more clouded. In their mind, they feel that there is no way out of this, and especially the pain. There's a lot of pain there. And sometimes individuals don't even necessarily want to die. They just want to stop the pain. But in their minds, they feel there is no other way out of this. This is the only way to stop the pain.
With Dr. Thomas Joyner, some of his work, I've read that to your point is that this is not an urgent or sudden, it just happened. This has been an ongoing, they've thought this through, they've worked through some solutions, and now their solution is to end their life. Mm-hmm.
So many things pile up. It's layers and layers and layers and layers for people. And it just gets to a point when you spiral so far down that you literally just can't even see the light anymore. It becomes the only way out for some people. It's not to say it's the right thing, but like when you're trying to psychologically make sense of it, you know, it's not about agreeing or not. It's just, this is what it's become. You can understand and see, okay, I see where the individual was. I don't agree with it, but we're really just seeing ultimately it's painted this picture, and you're able to like understand the story and just be like, wow, this is so unfortunate. So we need to be more proactive in trying to reverse that, not let people get to the point where they're spiraling. I'm not naive. We will not be able to save everyone. However, if there's one family, one officer that we can ultimately try to steer in a different direction so that they don't have to go through all of that, that would be great. I've sat with these families. They are ruined. The children, the significant others, partners, family, everybody. It doesn't matter how long it's been. It holds a very, very, very heavy effect on them. And if we can just try to reduce this a bit, that would be excellent.
Well, you bring up an interesting point too, as I'm sitting here thinking about your autopsy. I want to ask you a question about how you introduce, connect, and build trust, because as I'm thinking about walking into a family's home and saying, hey, will you open up your loved one's life completely to me? That must be a tall order. So I'd like to ask you the question, really, from two different platforms. How do you get families to open up to you? And then part two of that is, how do you get departments to open up to you? Because I could see a mountain of hurdles, potentially. I've not done it, but a mountain of hurdles on both. Walk us through kind of what that is. How do you approach that?
So I haven't really had to deal with the departments directly with the ones that I've done. It's really been as an officer and, you know, with as a mental health professional presenting to these families, you know, what I'm doing, why I'm doing this, and the data that I'm trying to collect so we can understand. I approach them in a way where I'm just letting them know, we want to understand this more. We want to have more information so that we can try to prevent this from happening to the next, right? It's heavy, it's difficult, but I have an approach where I definitely explain to the family, you know, this is what I'm doing, this is what I've been doing, this is what I've found, here's my background. And I totally put the ball in their court. I understand that we don't want to make people relive this, and it's difficult. I definitely have a period of time that I definitely want to stay in post it happening. You don't want to do it too soon. So it has to be at a point in time when the families are ready. Coworkers, I typically know when it occurred, and I just kind of navigate from there. I haven't really had, I mean, I'm sure there will be in the future. I really haven't had any family feel uncomfortable or not want to do it. I really try to show a lot of empathy, sympathy, and just respect for their situation. And I just kind of let them decide. Once I present all the information, I keep it completely transparent, let them know the confidentiality piece and how important that is to me. This is not something that's going to be given back to the departments or to coworkers, and this is going to be like, you know, the talked about event. And they just end up feeling so comfortable that they start to understand, like, wow, this would be maybe a way to kind of get some closure and have a lot of questions answered, because a lot of families ultimately do have a lot of questions that are unanswered. And the three main questions that we are trying to answer with the suicide psychological autopsies is, why suicide, why that day, and why those means. Those are the top three questions. And then obviously we get a lot more information.
Could you repeat those three questions? Say that again.
Why suicide, why that day, and why those means. And typically for law enforcement, I will say, out of all the first responders, a good chunk, over 90% of the cases are going to be their firearm because of accessibility as their duty weapon. So that's what we're typically going to see the most with law enforcement versus other occupations of first responders. You know, it could be a different means, right?
The No One Fights Alone podcast is excited to announce the launch of our new merchandise line. Now you can show your support for our mission by purchasing one of our hats, shirts, or hoodies. Our merchandise not only represents our brand and message, but also supports a great cause. A portion of all proceeds will go towards helping individuals and families affected by mental health. Wearing our merchandise not only spreads awareness for our podcast, but also serves as a reminder that no one has to fight alone. Join us in showing your support and spreading the message of hope and community by purchasing one of our No One Fights Alone items today from our website, nofapodcast.com, nofapodcast.com.
So this is a fascinating conversation. And as I'm thinking about this, these are just not talked about. How are these rare? How often are people doing suicide autopsies in our community?
I really haven't heard of many individuals doing them. I really never heard of them and even knew that they were a thing until I started to look into wanting to dive into finding out more and seeing how could I go about wanting. I had so many questions when these suicides would occur and ways that I would want to almost go and ask people these specific questions because psychologically it was kind of like I was dissecting it, you know, but I really haven't heard much about them. And that, I guess, you know, I'm in the Chicago area, so I don't know if maybe in a certain region they really are going on, but majority of the people, even when I talk to individuals in other states, other agencies, they're just kind of like blank, like what?
So do you perform autopsies for people who come to you and say, I have a family member or a loved one that I'd like to, or are you more specific, you seek them out?
So I have been seeking them out, but I have been at conferences and I have been at different trainings and events, and I've actually had individuals, I've had some chiefs approach me and ask about, like, wow, I've never heard of this. And we actually had a suicide and, you know, we're interested in maybe having one done. And so we go from there.
Well, I know at the end of our podcast, we always give our guests the opportunity to be found. So we'll give you that. And if anybody's interested in the autopsy, we'll circle back to that. But I find it interesting. And I think maybe some listeners are on here might find that valuable to their loss in some way. So let's keep that in mind. But in the autopsy itself, what we were talking about there was the family and how you interacted with them. I could see where you would have to build an enormous amount of trust because they're surrendering over what's left of their loved one to you for this information, for your findings. Is that fair?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, you're obviously doing good at it. You're right. Nobody really likes talking about this kind of thing. If you're finding information to fill in gaps, then, you're doing God's work, because these are such an enormous, negative, heavy, devastating impact on a person's life.
Yeah, when I actually do them, also I'm really getting into the mind of the individual, and I'm looking at a lot of these behaviors and their thought processes and everything that's going on with them, and it's pretty sad and it's devastating because I can see the struggle, I can see the crisis that the individual is going through, I can see the pain that they're enduring. And I feel that we owe it to those individuals and their families who have gone through this hell to try to help a future first responder or family not have to go through that. And so, yes, they're very informative, and there's a lot of pieces that we can take to try to be more proactive, but it's also very, it feels great to be able to try to honor these individuals by doing things differently as we move forward.
I feel like this, that you become, and correct me if I'm wrong here, if I'm misunderstanding or misstating, but you become their voice in a sense. You're speaking a little bit of insight into what they maybe were afraid to speak themselves or didn't know to speak. Maybe they were complex, and you know, the medications is a great point. Maybe they didn't know that they needed to have these conversations or know how to have these conversations. I feel like just hearing you speak that you maybe are advocating for them. Here's my story, and you're continuing their story. Is that fair?
Possibly. I never thought of it that way. I definitely have thought that I've discovered information that maybe a lot of people didn't understand and know. And so it's necessary to discuss, like, hey, this is what the individual is experiencing. There's a lot of emotions and a lot of pieces that individuals don't understand, right? Because like anything else in life, if we're not actually going through it, we don't fully, truly understand what it's like, right, to be in someone's shoes. And so a lot of the individuals that I talk to in general about suicide, when they don't know anything about this work, you know, there's a lot of emotions. There's a lot of anger. There's a lot of sadness. There's a lot of confusion. There's a lot that people feel and experience, right, when they learn that someone has died by taking their life. When individuals are experiencing high levels of pain emotionally, mentally, it's hard to understand how they would be able to do such a thing, right? Suicide, take their life. It's going to affect everyone. It's going to affect the loved ones, significant others, your children, right? How does someone take their life and leave their children behind that way? You know, when I do the psychoeducation, I do some scenario-based training, and we have a lot of conversation. One of the best ways that I can describe or give an example of the mindset of an individual who takes their life is if I were to sever my arm, or someone severs my arm now, and I'm on that floor and I'm bleeding out, right? I'm in a lot of pain. I can only assume, right? I've never had that happen, but I can assume that I'm in so much pain that I can't bear anything else but thinking of that pain. Now, I might think, oh my gosh, I'm going to die, right? I'm going to bleed out. I'm going to die. And in that moment, I'm going to think about the ones that I love the most, right? My children, my significant other, my family, my parents, etc. But at the end of the day, they are crossing my mind and I am worried about them. But at the end of the day, I am literally just focused on this pain because I can only, the severity of the pain that I'm experiencing is just overwhelming. I can't focus on anything else in that moment other than that level of pain. So in a sense, when people are in that kind of mental pain, emotional agony, etc., you know, they do love their family. But again, the pain level is so strong and it overcomes everything else. That's the best example I can give for the mindset and where a person is physiologically, psychologically, emotionally with this level of pain. And they feel they just can't see past that. And they just want to stop that pain.
Well, many times it's been portrayed, and pretty consistently in our culture, it's portrayed that it's a selfish act. And albeit there may be some elements of truth to it, I think there's a viewpoint that you're bringing up that is really important, that it may not actually be selfish to the person. Now that doesn't make sense. Mm-hmm. However, it made sense to them in that space that they are, especially with Joyner's work, when you become a burden, that was one of the key terms that he uses a lot in his work, is when you're helpless and you're worthless and hopeless, and you become such a burden that now that person thinks, well, I think everybody would be better off, including me, if I end my life. And that's a perspective that I think that is not talked about enough. And I think that's the point you're making. I hope I'm echoing it correctly.
Absolutely.
Because in their mind at that moment, that is the only thing they see, hear, feel inside and out is this enormous amount of pain.
Absolutely. And they just got to the point where they want to stop the pain.
Right. So let's move to some of the education then. So you're talking about helping, and which is kind of what we're doing here. You're talking about helping people understand. You've taken on this kind of as another facet of what you're doing, which is this education piece of helping people understand it. That part of it is these conversations of just, hey, there's more to this. It's more complex than just this immediate devastating act. There's more going on. What does that education really, what does that look like? What do you try to accomplish in that? And what's the, tell us a little bit about it.
So obviously there's a lot of data to support this curriculum. However, one of the things that I've learned throughout the years as a police officer is that training isn't always fun, right? Or psychoeducation, all of that. It's just not fun, right? We don't want to be there. We don't want to deal with it. And it doesn't
resonate. Especially now when we're inundated with mental health training.
Correct.
Another one of those.
Right. And the information can be extremely dry, and it's just presented sometimes in a manner that just does not fit well with us, right? So I've been that officer. I still am that officer in that seat and training where the information could be great. It's just one, it's not presented properly, right? You really need to know your audience, right? When it comes to first responders, there's a certain way that you should maybe present information. When it comes to mental health, especially, we're not going to be made clinicians, right? They're not there to make clinicians out of us. So you can't really present this information in a way that you would in a classroom full of academia, right? So for me, it was important that when I created and developed this curriculum, that it was created in a way where I'm not talking at first responders. I'm not sitting here trying to make clinicians out of them. And it's like, you know, all this jargon that they can't understand. It's really an interactive approach where we're having conversation. I want to hear from the group about their thoughts, what they know or don't know about suicide. We want this to be in trauma, right? This has to be a space where we're really starting to talk about this information, but still fill those gaps that we have as far as knowledge, right? We do scenario-based training, right? Sometimes we will have these scenarios that come up and we'll go through them. And a lot of first responders have these kind of like, wow, I never thought of it from that perspective kind of moments. And there's just a lot of information that we touch. There's a lot of, I've had many first responders say, I never really thought of it from that perspective. And that's something I didn't even know about. We think that everybody just, we assume that, oh, because we're first responders and we deal with so much, like we just naturally know just about everything. I mean, there's so much information, especially with trauma and suicide, we just don't know. And that's important for us to start tackling.
I know in developing, I share your burden there, because I know in developing our training for Chateau, it was how can we jazz this up? How can we make it a little more interesting, palatable, and sexy, and not so dry? And it sounds like that that you're taking this on with a deep rooted passion of experience as a police officer and saying, mm-hmm. Hey, I'm going to make this palatable and interesting. So it looks like we're kind of closing up here. So as we're wrapping up, if somebody wanted to look at your training, how would they find out, what some of the highlights of your training are, or the content of your training, and maybe, for lack of a better term, advertise, where do you advertise some of your training?
So I am actually certified in Illinois here under the Illinois Law Enforcement Training and Standards Board to provide this training within our state. We're working on getting that approved nationally as well with Idealist. But for the meantime, you definitely can go online to my not-for-profit Resilient Heroes, and you can just go to www.resilient-heroes.com, and you'll be able to see the work that we're doing and contact me regarding the suicide autopsies or actual training. And we've actually been going to a lot of different locations. Florida is becoming like a second home. There's a lot of work that I've been doing in other projects as well. And one of the other things that I recently just got back home from in Florida was working with Lynn University. So we're trying to really focus on not just educating our first responders, but also educating those clinicians that want to work with the first responder population and understanding our culture and know how to respond to us when we come in for therapy. And I think that that's super important, to have those individuals really prepared to deal with first responders and the levels of trauma that we're going to be coming to them with versus the general population, and it's definitely different levels of trauma.
Absolutely. I could not agree with you more. And this has been a fascinating conversation. I do want to point out something you just said there. Resilient Heroes is a not-for-profit organization. So do you take donations?
Absolutely. So we're trying to make sure that this information gets out, this psychoeducation and this level of training is spread out across the country. And I understand that sometimes agencies may have a hard time, right, with getting the training to their officers. And so absolutely having the public support first responders understand that, suicide is a huge problem. And there's a statistic, whether people are aware of it or not, that is very disturbing, in that an officer of law enforcement especially will die more likely by suicide than in the line of duty, like by getting shot or an accident or something. That's very disturbing. It's devastating. So we have a problem. We need to try to turn this around and do what we can other than just sit around and just continue to let the cycle continue of, it happens. Oh my gosh, we need to do something about it. And then we're back to business as usual.
So if you're training, you're sending to the website. If somebody wanted to donate towards that, how would they get a hold of you?
So you would go to the website, and we have launched our Hope for Heroes project. So you would just go onto that tab, and there is a button where you can donate. It is a 501c3, so it is, tax deductible for companies or individuals, and we would appreciate all the support.
Well, Liz, as we close up here, this has been amazing.
Email me, contact me by phone. I am also on LinkedIn. You can contact me at liz@resilientheroes.com is the email. You can call on my number, cell phone. You can reach me, 773-842-9784. Any questions, any concerns, I'm available.
Liz, as we kind of wrap this up, if people wanted to find you to either donate or just get a hold of you, maybe for an autopsy or the training at all, how do they find you? Email? I know we've talked about the website already. Social media, email, phone number, any of that?
Yeah, you can absolutely send me an email anytime, liz@resilientheroes.com. You can contact me via phone, 773-842-9784. Any which way I could help, questions, any concerns, training, just reach out to me.
That's awesome. Liz, you're a good soul and you're fun to be around. You're a pleasure. You're a treat. Although I still say I like Peter better. Peter's your husband. Played a round of golf with Peter for the listeners. He's amazing. He's a copper too, by the way. And I, in all seriousness, I really appreciate what you're doing. The endeavor and the task, the daunting task that you've undertaken. We need more people like you. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it. Thank you. My pleasure.
Chateau Health and Wellness is a 16-bed treatment facility nestled in the foothills of the Wasatch Mountains in Midway, Utah. Chateau's First Responder Resiliency Program is designed to treat the unique challenges and issues that first responders encounter in the course of their careers. Chateau's comprehensive and highly individualized approach to treatment addresses more than just the presenting issues. It addresses the why. Each of their seasoned, trauma-trained, and culturally competent therapists utilize evidence-based, specialized therapies to treat trauma at its core and enable clients to begin the healing process while developing a resilient and healthy relationship with stress. Chateau Health and Wellness is trusted by departments and agencies from around the country to treat responders and veterans. In fact, it is one of only a handful of facilities nationwide that is vetted and approved to treat members of the Fraternal Order of Police. For more information or to speak to a representative, go to chateaurecovery.com or call 888-507-5031.